Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Getting riled up on a Friday afternoon. And what's not to get riled up about, Taylor, when you're talking leverage loans? Well, we're going to go to Molly Smith. She's our corporate finance reporter here at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone here in New York. Molly, great to be with you. So remind us just at the top here, the leverage loans, a massive market. Why do we care about them, essentially? Like, where do they fit into the broader Wall Street picture?
Well, as you said, this is a massive market. We're talking now at least the same size as possibly larger than the high yield market. Leverage loans have become a huge part of companies' financing as the Fed has been hiking interest rates and investors have been seeking floating rate debt. The loan structure certainly provides you a bit more of a buffer in a rising interest rate environment, and that's why we've seen leverage loans become one of the best performing fixed income asset classes this year.
So they perform better perhaps than regular bonds in rising interest rates, but it's very interesting because in the late stage of the business cycle, you sometimes start to see investors not quite measure out the risk and reward. Maybe they're coming with fewer protections, they're coming at covenant light. Why are these investors starting to push back now and demand what they think is a fair valuation?
Right. So we've started to see a greater percentage of investors demanding better pricing terms really throughout the summer. Some of that has just been from just the supply and demand technicals that investors have had a bit more of that in their favor and a better balance. But also, you know, with you start to get a little nervous when you're getting toward the end of a credit cycle or what appears to be. And with so many issuers going toward loan-only structures, when you don't have another debt, any other junior debt below you, that can be concerning when there's not a buffer to absorb some of those losses when a borrower defaults.
And Molly, I know one of the reasons that people track this so closely, and we should point out, Taylor, that this story, Molly's story today, is the 10th most read story in all of the Bloomberg universe today over the last 8 hours. So clearly something that people are tracking. One of the reasons they look at it, I go back to my private equity days, Molly, these are often the instruments that are used to fund a leveraged buyout, as the name might tip you off to. What does it tell us about the appetite on the part of the private equity firms who use these instruments? How are they doing at this point in the cycle?
Well, these are really the kinds of deals exactly that investors are pushing back on. It's a lot of these leveraged buyouts, LBOs, as you said, that tend to come with more aggressive terms, the covenant light that Taylor had mentioned. And when you're, you know, trying to put that up in this late in the cycle, investors are starting to get a bit weary and say, like, no, you know, we want better pricing, a bigger discount,
right,
a stronger call protection.
Because what we should point out, Mike, what covenant light basically means is that there aren't as many protections for the investors if the earnings fall and it becomes more difficult. It becomes a more difficult investment. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So covenants are, you know, just meant to be investor protections, like protecting against, you know, a drop in earnings is one such covenant that can be in bond or loan documents. And you've really seen the quality of those documents deteriorate in the loan market, especially.
And that really jumped out at me, Taylor, because, of course, it takes us back to the LBO boom of 06 and 07. And one of the things that jumped out at me in Molly's story was that 80% of leveraged loans are covenant light, cov light. In 06, 07, that proportion would have been less than 25%.
Wow.
And that was a time when people were like, money's free. Let's do this. Let's do this deal. This is amazing.
Well, and probably I wonder if some of that is leading to reasons why we're seeing such outperformance.
Yeah.
Molly, can you talk us about the outperformance, especially relative to some of like treasuries or high yield debt?
Exactly. So from that kind of perspective, it may seem like investors are turning somewhat of a blind eye to the risks that we've discussed and really just throwing their money into loans, because in fixed income this year, it's been really rough. I mean, investment grade for the first half of this year was, I mean, down at least 2.5%. Treasuries have been, you know, a tough asset class to invest in as well. High yield, kind of flat for the year, and we've definitely seen the struggle in emerging markets, especially recently. So for fixed income investors, loans have really been like one of the few safe places to go.
Well, one of the few safe places to go in the past. Going forward, what are you hearing about how they perform going forward, especially as you said, we might be nearing the end of the credit cycle? What happens when things turn?
Right. So when we're looking at these kinds of deals that are really putting a ton of leverage onto the transaction and the borrower, and especially if you don't have that junior debt below you, that means as the loan investor, your recoveries are looking a lot lower than what they historically have been. And in that same Moody's report that Jason had just referenced, that Moody's had discussed that idea as well. Like, for example, on the first lien tranche, maybe you used to get around 77 cents, now looking at closer to 61 cents on the dollar. And for the second lien, even worse, maybe used to get 43 cents, now likely around 14. So that's just, it's just that much worse when the cycle does turn.
Right. Great stuff. Molly Smith, corporate finance reporter for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone here on a Friday afternoon. So, Taylor, records. Tell me. Talk to me.
Tons of record highs pretty much across all the major indices. The one that caught my eye was the Russell 2000. It was interesting because yesterday we had the weaker dollar, but still some gains in the Russell. That is happening again. We are at a record high. And the NASDAQ, Jason, the NASDAQ is now at a record high again as well. And some of the biggest movers that we would know in the NASDAQ are some of those big tech companies like Netflix,
right?
Everyone sort of doing well.
Right. And, you know, we've heard a lot about retail this week. And so it is a broad-based series of gains. It seems like we're obviously going to be digging into that a lot through the course of the afternoon as we get about an hour and a half away now from the close of trading. This is Bloomberg.
If you drive a car, car, tax the street. If you drive to six,
I'll tax your seat.
If you get to tax the seat. Here we go. It is always a good day on a Friday. You know, it's not even tax day, and I feel like we're always talking about taxes here.
Well, especially the last couple days when everybody's taxes are going to go up right around here, Taylor.
So we have Laura Davidson joining us. She's our tax reporter over here for Bloomberg News. Laura, you had another great story out about how we have 4 days now to try to beat that SALT cap limit. Can you just quickly, though, recap for us what we got yesterday and how that folds into today? We did get those headlines yesterday that the IRS now is trying to block New York and New Jersey, whose states have tried to bypass some of this SALT cap. What does all this mean?
So So the tax law from 2017 really cut back the amount of property taxes, state income taxes that people can deduct. So high tax states like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut pass some state laws that say, hey, we can kind of help our residents out and create these state tax credit programs that will allow them to turn these payments into charitable contributions, and they can deduct that on their federal return. The IRS said, hey, look, this is no good. But one thing that's interesting is the effective date for this regulation is August 27th. So you have until Monday to potentially be able to make one of these payments and get the deduction. It's a little bit of a Hail Mary pass. You have to be in a place where they already have this fund set up and they're able to take your payment. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, your tax advisor may say, hey, yeah, you know, if you act quickly, you can save a little bit of money on your taxes.
All right. So let's bring in a guy who can tell us exactly whether this is indeed going on. Michael Daddio is principal of tax and business services at Marcum. Michael, is your phone ringing a lot? How did you find time to talk to us here?
The phone is ringing off the hook. This is the year that just keeps on giving, because
yeah,
the service just keeps giving guidance to us. Spread out over a period of time and just raises additional questions. So it's been busy.
And Michael, I mean, you say it's busy. I want to get a sense of how much of a scramble it is, especially because we just heard from Laura that some cities and places and systems don't even have it set up yet where you could file by the 27th, even if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, that whole issue about the effective date, it sounds as if, and I think the Treasury Secretary kind of issued a statement that indicated that he believes the proposed regs really apply to states like Connecticut, New York, New Jersey that passed a workaround. There are other states that have tax credit programs, particularly with respect to educational contributions,
and
where they're already set up. So I think, you know, a lot of, like, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York don't really have the tax-exempt organization set up, whereas these other states do. So this could really be a last-ditch effort for them to make contributions, because the regs themselves don't seem to exempt those prior programs.
And so, Michael, just going down into the weeds a little bit here. So what have some jurisdictions done? I mean, Scarsdale, I believe, has already created – it's a charitable situation, right, where people can essentially donate and then get an offset to their taxes. Keep me honest here.
Yeah, effectively what the legislation in the particularly Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey did is they allowed municipalities to set up tax-exempt organizations. You then can make contributions to the tax-exempt organization. You say it is a charitable contribution, so therefore if you're over the $10,000 limit for adjusting your taxes on Schedule A, that doesn't apply because this is a charitable contribution. It comes off as a deduction other place on the Schedule A. And then the municipality gives you a percentage credit depending upon, you know, where you are. The credit may be 80%, 90%, 85%, depends on the state. So the state makes, or the municipality makes out a bit, because the credit that they're giving you is a little bit less than the cash you're putting out as the quote contribution. But you as a taxpayer do better, because if you just paid it as a property tax or an income tax, you'd be limited by the $10,000 deduction, so you'd get none of it, and now you're trying to get the charitable contribution deduction.
Right.
Laura, in your story, you've talked a lot about New York, New Jersey, Connecticut passing laws to allow for charitable contributions. I remember a while ago New York had floated the idea of a payroll tax as, again, another way to sort of get around these. What other states and what other ideas are being floated out there to also help offset this additional burden?
So the payroll tax is certainly out there. That is still happening. Basically, what happens there is your employer would have to opt into this program, sort of pay your taxes for you and give you a credit so you could get a deduction. So it's a little bit complicated how it works. The issue there, though, is that employers to do that would probably have to lower your pay. So that's a really hard sell to employees to say, hey, we'll pay your taxes, but we're going to pay you $10,000 less.
Right.
Even if you end up being a good deal, that's a really hard sell to prospective employees.
We'll see how that pans out. It's not super popular yet. No companies have until December to sign up for that. Also in Connecticut, and Mike can tell you, they have another tax program that they passed there for owners of pass-throughs. So these are, you know, partnerships, S-corporations, basically kind of a similar thing of a way to reduce the tax burden so it's paid at the business level instead of the individual, kind of an incentive to keep business owners in the state instead of having them flee to lower tax states.
That's Laura Davidson, our tax reporter down in Washington, D.C. for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone, as well as Michael Daddio, principal of Tax and Business Services. He is based in Connecticut, joining us on the phone as well. This is a story, Taylor, that is not going on. It's been amazing just to watch it on the Bloomberg, how high it bounces.
And I can't wait until 5 or 10 years from now we can go back and analyze the demographic shifts. Because I know, for example, in Illinois, after a lot of their budget problems the last few years, you did see some out-migration. Everyone keeps threatening to leave, but you really wonder, would you really leave New York? So I wonder again in a few years from now how we can track the demographic shifts and if it really does come down to that, that people do end up wanting to leave or not.
Well, and there's also obviously, as there seems to always be these days, a political element to this as well. You know, this was seemingly very targeted. It's one of a number of things that have come down the political pipe. But, you know, it really is pike. It is starting to hit people in the pocketbook, and it may affect home sales as well. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Wow, some soulful music to bring in our next guest. First joining us, Michael McKee. I have been seeing his handsome face and listening to the sultry sounds of his voice all over the past couple days. He is out at the Kansas City Fed's annual symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And sitting right next to me and Taylor Riggs here in our Bloomberg 1130 studio is Matt Bosler, Federal Reserve reporter. I want to go out to you first, Mr. McKee. You've had just a bunch of rock star interviews so far, but let's start with Chairman Powell. What did you hear from him today that caught your attention?
Basically that it's steady as she goes. There's not a whole lot of news in it. He did discuss the economy at length, which is kind of different. People weren't sure he was going to do that, given the fact that markets often misinterpret, but he was very careful to say what we're doing now is working, and there are risks to doing something else, so we're going to stick with what our plan is.
And so, you know, given that you're there, were people to, you know, sort of sitting around being like, all right, yawn, you know, let's go for a hike? Or what was the sort of the mood there?
I think people were interested in his argument and interested in some of the historical comparisons he drew. He went through the great inflation of the 1960s and 70s and then the great moderation under Alan Greenspan and how the Fed reacted in both cases, sometimes correctly, sometimes wrong. You know, what people liked was the analogies he used. He used a lot of nautical analogies, steering by the stars in particular, talking about R star and U star and P star, the various nicknames for concepts the Fed discusses. They found that interesting, but there was no real conclusion to it, no change in thinking. So people were kind of ready. Okay, we've heard it. Now let's move on to the topic of the day.
Yeah.
Well, and Powell might have been a little bit quiet, but Mike, you did get some news from some of the other interviews you did. I'm thinking Loretta Mester, Robert Kaplan. What were your key takeaways from those interviews?
Well, you know, it's basically that those who think we should raise rates still think we should raise rates. And Jim Bullard, who doesn't think we should be raising at all, still thinks we shouldn't be raising at all. I saw some analysis earlier today that said the markets moved a little bit in a hawkish direction because of the interviews that we were doing. But you have to realize those people were already calling for higher rates. So it really isn't a surprise that they have stuck with that call because there's been no change in the economy. Growth has been strong, as predicted. Inflation has been relatively stable, as predicted. And until there's a change, it's not likely that most members of the Open Market Committee are going to change their view. Jim Bullard, a perfect example, he's been saying for years we shouldn't raise rates at all because there's not a problem with inflation and interest rates as a whole are lower than they have been in the past. And he's sticking to that call.
And we're also joined here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York by Matt Bosler. He's our Federal Reserve reporter. Matt, what did you make of all of this as it plays back here in New York, both in terms of markets and then the comments we just heard about rates and inflation?
It was interesting because, as Mike said, there was a little bit of a hawkish market reaction this morning after some of those interviews. Short-term interest rates went up a little bit. And then when Jay Powell spoke, they actually went back down. So that was initially taken as dovish, but now they're back up to the levels where they were this morning after some of those initial interviews. So I guess on net, the takeaway for investors out this way is maybe a slightly hawkish message from the Fed, all things considered today. The interesting thing was, so Jay Powell, as Mike said, kind of laid out how they're looking at the economy, sort of the framework that they're using. But we got a little bit more color on, you know, putting that into practice from some of the other Fed officials today. And so that kind of leans in a hawkish direction, all told.
So, Mike, got to ask you, what else are people talking about sort of behind the scenes? Again, you know, kind of outside of the panels, you know, you mentioned a little bit of the reaction to Powell himself. But, you know, what's being talked about over coffee and over drinks and on those aforementioned hikes, if anybody's doing that? I'm just jealous that, you know, people are out there in the mountains, clearly. I keep bringing it up.
Yeah, they're having lunch right now, and so they're going to be leaving on hikes in about 40 or 45 minutes if you can get here, Jason.
Okay.
We'll save a spot for you going up into the mountains. I think they've obviously been talking about Trump and tariffs, but from an economist's point of view, and what I mean by that is that they're saying, you know, it's really hard to model the effects of these things because there's so many different supply chains involved, and some people absorb costs, and some people pass on costs, and some people change the supply chain. So he says it's really hard to know what the impact is going to be. They don't think it's going to be large unless the trade wars escalate. The other thing they're talking a lot about is emerging markets and the impact that the U.S. has on other markets because the world is dollarized, basically, and so many borrow in dollars that if the Fed keeps raising rates and we do have any kind of issues, you already see it in Turkey and Argentina, then maybe people could have trouble paying back their loans. General consensus is, as John Connolly once said, it's our dollar, but your problem. It's your bad policies that lead you to borrow excessively, and it's our responsibility to raise raise rates for the United States. But those are kind of the two things that people have been talking about beyond the conference topic and whether or not the Fed raises rates in September and December. Right.
And bringing this full circle, when we just heard Mike McKee talk about uncertainty as it relates to emerging markets and tariffs, Matt Bosler, you had an interesting story out yesterday about how Powell's speech mirrors a 1998 paper that reflects a similar debate here about aggressive policy in the face of uncertainty. What was that about?
He alluded to that a little bit in the speech today, actually, where he was talking about inflation expectations and how, you know, if you start to see movement in inflation expectations, that's when kind of all bets are off. So the standard story goes that, you know, if you're not sure about things like exactly where the natural rate of unemployment is, for example, you tread lightly, you go cautiously. But the flip side of that is if you start to see inflation expectations go up, for example, then you realize you might be misestimating that natural rate of unemployment, and it actually you know, begs for a more aggressive response and kind of ditching that cautious playbook. And so that was something he alluded to. Obviously, we're not seeing much of a pickup in inflation expectations right now, mm-hmm. so that's maybe a story for another day, but it does kind of put that on the radar as something to keep an eye on.
Matt Bosler, our Federal Reserve reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us here in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. Michael McKee, international economics and policies correspondent, joining us from Jackson Hole. Mike will have an interview with Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic coming up at just after 4 p.m. Wall Street time. Looking forward to that. We're going to let Mike go and prep and get all pretty for that as well. Taylor, interesting comments.
Yeah,
I like this.
You know, and one thing that we didn't quite have the chance to get to when we spoke with Yelena Shelyacheva, our Bloomberg economist earlier this week, was about structural changes and how that impacts some of the models that we're looking at. And if there has been a structural change, do you need a new model? We just spoke with Matt about uncertainties about where the neutral rate is. So I'd be interested as well to see what else we could glean from that.
Petty on a Friday afternoon. The Night Watchman, the modern Night Watchman, Taylor, has to do with cybersecurity. That is for sure. And so we bring in Nir Pollack. He is the chief executive officer of Exabeam, joining us on the phone from San Mateo, California. Nir, great to be with you. You are at the center of obviously something that concerns all of us on a daily, if not hourly, basis. You just closed a new round of funding. You've got some huge backers behind you, including Lightspeed Venture Partners. So where does Exabeam fit into the new ecosystem around cybersecurity?
Hey, hi, Jason. Hi, Taylor. Thanks a lot for having me. So Exabeam, we're in the cybersecurity market. We're in what's called security management. In essence, a lot of the enterprises out there that are afraid of the cyber threats have put a lot of different investments in security controls, if it's firewalls or it's antivirus capabilities. And the threats are complicated. They could be coming from mobile in the cloud or within their data centers or even their corporate networks. And we are the ones that try to make sense of all that, find those adversaries, be it the Russians, be it a cyber crime ring somewhere. And we get to get a front seat to manage that security posture.
So, Nir, what about your business makes you different or better than some of the other competitors out there?
So we were built, you know, we have a modern security platform. We were built natively that combines big data. You know, if you think about it, it's a big data platform, big data problem. You have multiple data sets coming from cloud, mobile, anywhere. We use artificial intelligence, really trying to remove the human out of the equation to being able to combat threats and also automate the response to make sure that it's not humans conducting investigations and mitigations, but it's the machine doing it for them. So we're kind of built on a modern stack to be able to do that.
So, Nir, we've been talking today in part because the stock is up so dramatically about Splunk and where it sits in the market. It feels like you guys are pretty unabashedly taking them on full frontal. Tell us how that matchup goes.
Sure. So, you know, we're smaller than Splunk. We're a lot earlier than Splunk. We also maniacally, we're early stage. We're 5 years old, to give you a sense. So, yes, we've done a funding round right now, about $50 million. So we have about $118 million of investment to date. So we're still private. And what we do in order to kind of build and grow the companies, we track ourselves against other publicly traded companies in security where we're at our stage. Mm-hmm. To give you a sense, we're tracking higher than where Splunk was at our age. So we're grabbing market share. We grew 300%, 17 over 16. We grew double and a half, 18. So it's high growth for us. And we're able to take a lot of market share from them also by our winning rate. So right now we're beating them more than 70% when we go to head-to-head battles at customers.
Nir, we got some news yesterday that Google had hired FireEye and some other top security consultants, in part because they had identified and terminated 39 YouTube channels that were linked to Iran. So how do you view your own partnerships as you start to see some other deals happening or a potential exit strategy as you look to raise more funding?
So to do security management right, it's all about the partnerships around you because you're kind of like Switzerland. You're trying to work well with everyone, if it's Microsoft or Google or Amazon or even any one of the security providers. So we have a very strong business development area and alliances where we build technical integrations with each one of these vendors to be able to ingest their data, make intelligence actions out of their data, and automate the response. So in order to kind of succeed in security management, by definition, you need to have a good eco-partner system around you.
Nir, I want to ask maybe a basic question. From your perspective, where do you see the most attacks coming? You know, we heard about YouTube from Google. We hear about Facebook. You have the Experian data hack. Where are you seeing most of these cybersecurity attacks? Because they are so complicated these days.
They are. Maybe I'll explain. It depends really who the target is. And I can't share too much. We do see a lot, and we have a front seat to a lot of these different attacks, successful or not. What I would say is if you look at the government, you know, and our federal customers, it's a lot about nation states.
Yeah.
And that would be the Russians and the Chinese. It's not any different than what you hear about in the news. We just get to see it front. The second one is if you're talking about health. And there's a lot of breaches around different blues, insurers, and providers. Mm. That's typically a lot of cybercrime rings. So those would come from Russia or the Ukraine and the likes. So it really depends on who what's the data, what's the asset one's going after, and who's interested in it. If it's a financial gain, it's typically the cybercrime rings. If it's for, you know, industrial or economical purposes, it's going to be a nation state behind it.
Got it.
And it's sometimes even hard to say because sometimes nation states are going to use cyber crimes as kind of middlemen to conduct their work for them.
Nir Pollack, you are the chief executive officer of Exabeam, joining us on the phone from San Mateo, California. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, and he's smart. He can't tell us too much information. He'll give away all the strategies. But
Absolutely.
That was still very interesting.
Very interesting. And obviously, he is right in the middle of the issue, truly, of our times, especially as we get toward midterm elections. It feels like the headlines every day remind us of all of those vulnerabilities on a corporate and governmental level. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
Driver, take a break. We can reach our destination.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Oh, the Drive to the Close music. I'm going to miss that next week when I'm no longer here on the afternoon shift. But you know what is good is we're looking at record stocks across all of the major averages, and joining us to break all of this down is Charlie Babrinskoy. Jason, he's the vice chairman and head of the investment group over at Ariel Investments. They have now about $13.6 billion in assets under management. He joins us from Chicago. Charlie, I just want to get your thoughts here. You talk about the length of the bull market is irrelevant. We continue to see more record stocks today, the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Russell 2000, the Wilshire 5000. What's driving this rally and these record highs today?
You know, one comment I want to make is that stocks are supposed to hit records. And the reason they're supposed to hit records is because companies only pay out about half of the profits that they earn in dividends. They reinvest the other half in their business, or they use those retained earnings to buy back stocks. So just in the normal course of things, stocks are going to be worth more every year. And that has happened for 100, 150 years. So stocks hitting records is really not some reason to be nervous about the outlook.
It's just a reason for us in the media to get really excited, Charlie. It's nothing more than that. I mean, we're Bloomberg after all. These are the cheap thrills we get, right? So I got to ask you, you know, this is happening with a backdrop of global trade war, new tariffs rolling on. It feels like almost every day, talks breaking down with Mexico around NAFTA. And yet that doesn't seem to be playing into the market. Where do you come down on that?
I'd say the market is properly focused on what we call the three things: tariffs, treasury bonds, and Trump. Mm. And the market is spending a lot of time evaluating all three of those. In our view, the market doesn't think that Trump is going to be a big issue. We've all gotten used to the things he says out of Washington, the irreverent tweets, but there's unlikely to be a change in government. Treasury bonds, everybody pretty much understands that the Federal Reserve is going to tighten. They've been very open about what they're going to do, and so higher interest rates do matter, but people understand that. The wild card is tariffs. There's no doubt about it. People like myself are optimistic that we are going to get a new deal with Mexico, probably a new deal with Canada, and we'll accomplish something on China. And the reason we're optimistic is President Trump's supporters, or farmers tend to be supporters of President Trump, and tariffs would be very tough on farmers. And so we think he will do what he has to do to make sure that they don't feel the brunt of this in the next 3 months.
Charlie, I want to quickly go back to the second T that you mentioned, treasuries. We heard from Fed Chairman Powell. We heard from we will hear from some other Fed officials in Jackson Hole later on at this hour. I want to ask the simple question about how do equities perform in the face of rising rates, and at what level in rates do you see, or you think we'll see, to where the rotation out of equities into bonds starts to happen that hurts stocks as those yields start to become more and more attractive?
That is the great question, and unfortunately, I and other people don't know for sure, but the basic rule is that if interest rates go up because we have a strong economy and because people are not rushing to safety, then that's okay. The market can do okay with a strong economy and higher rates. The dangerous period is when you get higher inflation pushing up interest rates. You have the bad without the good. And so that's what happened in the late 70s, early 80s. You had a lot of inflation, didn't have strong economy, and the market can get hit hard. A higher discount rate also means that companies who are making money in the distant future, the market brings those future earnings back at a higher discount rate. And so growth stocks and tech stocks tend to do badly when interest rates are increasing.
So, Charlie, I got to ask you about a name that apparently you like, and that's CBS, which obviously has been in the headlines for, you know, not a lot of great reasons over the past few months and for all sorts of things. Why do you like that stock?
Because our investment philosophy is based on finding companies with a great long-term outlook that have some kind of short-term problem. We think the market tends to focus on the short-term and the headlines, as you correctly pointed out. There are short-term problems, there's no doubt about it. But we think that over the next 2 years, CBS earnings are going to be up about 50%. Over the last 3 years, they've been up 60%. So the fundamentals at CBS are excellent. There's no distribution system that can live without having CBS programming. Content matters more than ever. More dollars are spent in political advertising every year, and all of that benefits CBS. and yet the stock is trading for less than 10 times earnings because of these short-term issues around the merger with Viacom.
Charlie, we don't have a lot of time. In 30 seconds or less, can you talk to us about the retail sector? Some of the biggest losers, say, in the S&P 500 are Foot Locker, Gap, Macy's, L Brands. What's your take on some of the retail and the consumer sectors?
Just wildly disparate results. You've got some of those names that have done spectacularly well this year. We own Nordstrom. It's done wonderfully. Macy's has actually done well. Home Depot's done well. And other names have gotten crushed. The JCPenney's of the world, obviously. Sears has performed very badly. So it's just haves and have-nots. The haves are taking much more share, mostly if they get the e-commerce part of it right. If they don't, there's really no bottom.
Truly a place where people are treading carefully. Charlie Babrinskoy, Vice Chairman and Head of the Investment Group at Ariel Investments, $13.6 billion under management, joining us from Chicago.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.